Warning. This episode may not be suitable for some listeners. Listener discretion advised.
Things took a turn for the worse. When I was 14, just before I went, get sent to the care home, I met a girl in my local area. We were in the same class at school. We started dating, going out together. And just before I went into the care home, she fell pregnant with my child. So we were both 14 years old.
Hello, this is Unexpected Turns with myself, Anne Dibben, and alongside me are Julie Tattersall and Beverly Evans.
Today we are going to talk to Steve Murray.
Every few months, Steve moved home and schools. Always the outsider, he longed for stability.
By the age of 14, was taking drugs and spending very little time attending school. It wasn't long before the drugs took a real hold on his life and he ended up homeless.
Yet somehow, he's now drug-free and in a very good relationship with a loving family and a very successful business.
So, let's hear Steve's story.
Good afternoon, Steve.
Good afternoon.
We're delighted that you're here with us, with Bev and I, on this rather rainy day. What's it like where you are?
It's exactly the same for Scottish weather.
Well, you're here to brighten our day. Whereabouts are you exactly?
I live in a place called Loch Lomond in Scotland.
Oh, wow.
It's very beautiful. It's very lovely. Full of mountains, lochs. The scenery is amazing. But when you live here, I think you forget to appreciate it daily. It's just on your doorstep.
Yeah.
I live in the Beacons, the Brecon Beacons, Stephen. Again, it's beautiful. You know, we're surrounded by lovely mountains and countryside rivers.
Yeah.
I found since owning a dog and getting out every day and just looking up and breathing, you know, and just taking it all in has been so good for my well-being and just helps you to appreciate where you live, as you say.
Of course.
It is. So, Steve, you've not had it easy. Could I take you right back to your childhood? Could you tell us a little bit about what it was like for you as a child?
As a child, I would say my life was very pleasant up until a certain age. So I was brought up with my brothers, my mother and father, and we lived in the local area where I still live today until I would say I was 7 years old, and that's the first big trauma that happened in my life, and my mum and father divorced. And that was very traumatic for me. I felt pulled between the two. I didn't know who I wanted to live with. I didn't understand divorce meant divorce, and that was it. So I used to cry and cry to go live with my father, and then I would go stay with my father for a week, and then I would cry and cry to go live with my mother. And then I would go to my mother, and that all I was doing inside was I was just trying to get them back together again.
Yeah.
But I didn't realise that divorce meant divorce. So I would say up until I was 7, I had a very normal, everyday, boisterous life that I went out and played with my friends and had fun. And then my mother and father divorced, and that really upset the apple cart, so to speak.
I remember you saying you had numerous different schools through your primary. How many schools were you at?
Yeah, so after my mum and father divorced, they went to court to fight for full custody. And my father won full custody of me and my brothers, which was unheard of in the 80s, going into the 90s. Usually our mother would get 99% right straight away. But my father won full custody. So we went and moved in with my father, and he just started seeing my stepmom at the time and decided he wanted a fresh start in life. So he got offered a job down in Hull, in Humberside, and just moved us all down straight to Hull. So getting there, it was nervous. I was 7 years old. I was away from my mum. I was staying with my dad and his new girlfriend. and we had to live in a caravan park. I think it was called Witherinsea Caravan Park. So we
Right.
stayed there first, a few months in the caravan, and then we spent our Christmas in the caravan, first Christmas away from my mum. And after that, my dad seemed to get a job. He was a very good handyman, so he was very good with his hands, doing the odd jobs here and there, whatever it was. So he got a job with a gentleman and his wife who would buy rundown properties, rundown houses, and my dad would fix them up for him. But that entailed us living in the house while my dad was fixing the houses up. And after the house was fixed up and ready for someone to live in, we would move out and move into another rundown property that my dad would fix. So that was his way of getting free rent, I suppose. So in the course of me being 7 until 13, 6 years I spent with my dad and my stepmom. We lived in 19 different houses. I've been to so many different primary schools. It was very, very hard for me to get friends. And I think that's because, not just because I was always uprooted and moved somewhere else, I think because I was Scottish didn't help. In the 90s, it was very, oh, he's a jock and all the rest of it, and bullying came into play. So I never made friends because I knew if I did make a friend, I wasn't going to see them again very soon. I was going to be moved again onwards. So around the Humberside, Yorkshire, Leeds, Bradford area, yeah, 19 different houses I remember staying in, and countless primary schools that I attended, even if it was only for 4 or 5 months at a time,
That was really hard then for a young lad.
Yeah, it was.
How old were your brothers?
My older brother was 4 years older than me, so he was 11. And my younger brother was a baby at the time. So my father decided by the court that because he was a baby and he was too young to be on like normal food and that, he needed his mother at that time. He would need to bond with his mother. So even though my father won custody, he did say to my mother, "You can keep the baby because I think the baby should stay with me. He's too young to be taken away from his mother." So my little brother stayed with my mother in Scotland, and myself and my oldest brother moved with my father and my stepmom.
So hard, isn't it? You need that stability. I mean, as teachers, Bev and I know how hard it is to be the new kid in the class as a teacher, but to be the new kid in the class with a different accent 19 times, it's,
Yeah, it was very tough. I wanted to make friends. There was people I wanted to stay at certain schools. I loved certain teachers and loved the school, but I just knew I wasn't going to be there very long, and we'd move again. So yeah, we moved all over Bradford, all over Leeds, all over Hull, all over Grimsby, areas like that around the West Yorkshire area. And we did stay in some different houses all the time. Like I said, my father would do them up, fix them all up as we're living in it. And before you knew it, the house was finished and we moved on to somewhere else. I think my older brother, Alex, at the time, he found it particularly difficult because he was at a stage where he was just starting to become a teenager. So I remember one house we stayed in, and we were there for about 6 months, and he got a girlfriend, and they obviously fell in love with each other. 6 months later, my dad says, "Right, that's us. We need to go. We need to move." And I remember him crying and crying because he didn't want to leave his girlfriend, and that stuck with me because I thought that's sad, that we're just uprooted again. But I think my dad was trying to provide the best way he could for us. He didn't think about our emotional well-being. He just thought about getting food in our belly, clothes in our back, making
Absolutely.
sure that we had heat in the house.
When did this ever stabilize? Did you put down roots anywhere? Or how long did this?
No.
No. So
No.
when did this sort of downward spiral start for you? What
Was there a particular catalyst for this, Steve?
Yes, I think, as I said, I was 7 to the age of 13. I stayed with my father. So my brother was 4 years older than me. So I started seeing my brother starting to rebel against my dad once he became a teenager and saying, I'm fed up, I'm moving, I don't want to do this anymore. And, it was
Yeah.
hard. So I was looking at my brother and I'm feeling the same way, but too young to maybe say it. So my dad moved back to Scotland with my stepmom. Bearing in mind, since the 6 years we were in England, my stepmom had three other boys, so I've got three other brothers. So she had three
Right.
other children to my father. And they moved back to Scotland with my three brothers as well, my three younger brothers and my older brother. So we moved back when I was 13 years old, and we stayed in a place not far from where I am today. And then my dad got offered another house, and he thought, right, I'm going to take that other house because they now were in it, like a five apartment, say it was, with me and all my brothers. But the other house was in a nicer area and it had a front and back door. And I remember my brother standing up and saying, I'm not going. I'm just not moving anymore. I've made friends here. I'm 16 years old. There's nothing you can do about it. I'm staying here. So I think I was 12, 13 at the time, and my brother stayed. We moved away again. And that's when I started really resenting my school, resenting people, like teachers, even though they never done anything wrong to me. I would resent the teachers, resent the school, resent any authority whatsoever. I didn't want to be told where I was going to be living, what I was going to be doing anymore. I seen my brother standing up to my father, and I thought, I don't want this either. I want to just have a home where I can live and grow up and be me. So about the age of 13, that's I started rebelling. My dad couldn't really take it anymore, maybe with the stresses of my stepmom, with the pressures from her as well. Like Stephen's getting out of hand, he's not listening in school, he's not doing this, he's not doing that. And maybe my dad's hands were tied, but he says, well, if you want, you can go back and stay with your mother. So at 14 years old, well, 13, 13 and a half, I went back to move in with my mother. So that was another big turning point for me.
Oh gosh.
Was that relationship still strong? Because you spent a long time without her.
Yeah, it always was strong, yes. I had a really good relationship with my mother. So I knew straight away, I was accepted straight away back into the house. She'd moved on and married my stepdad, which she's still married to today. She never had any more children. So my little brother, who stayed with my mum, still lives with my mum just now. So the thing is, yeah, I moved back in with my mum and I felt, right, this could be good. The only downside to that is because my mum hadn't seen me all them years, her way of showing love wasn't so much in hugs and kisses. Her way of showing love was to let me away with anything I wanted. So that was probably tough for her.
Making up for all that time she wasn't with you. And yeah, I can understand
Yes.
just wanting you to be happy. And
Wanted me to be happy, however, I had in me that I didn't like authority. I didn't like being told what to do anymore. So I
no.
went to my mother's with that same attitude. And it was a shame because I started rebelling in school, not listening to people, not even listening to my mother. And she's trying to do good for me. But her way of showing love, like I said, was just to kind of let me away with those things.
Yeah.
And so when you say you were rebelling in school, I mean, what happened as a result of that?
As a result, bunking, we call it bunking school up here. So, truancy, you go in the morning for your morning registration and then you leave for the rest of the day. So, it looks as if you've been in that day. That's what I'd done most days. I got up to no good. I was hanging around with older boys in school. I was just wanting to do what they were doing. thought it was the in thing, the cool thing, not listening to teachers, just not attending school. I think my old report card was like 90% unattendance rating. So I was very, very rarely at school. So that led to me going to a children's panel. So I had to sit in front of a children's panel. Social workers started to get involved. And from there, they gave me another chance at school, thought I would be better if I moved school. So they moved me again to another high school. And the same thing with the other high school. I just never really listened to anyone. The teachers were trying to tell me things and help me out, but I just never took it on board. And for that, I get sent back again to another children's panel. And that's the day they decided that I would be better off in a care home, a residential home where I would be locked in and they would have a school inside the home. So I get sent to a children's home for boys.
Oh, God, how old were you then?
I just turned 14 years old.
Gosh. And so, how did that work out?
That was very hostile place. It was called Cardiff Park Home for Boys. And it was very, very much abusive staff,
Oh.
verbally and physically. They had the power to restrain you in more ways than one. I had hands put right up my back. I had their knees on my neck on the ground. They forcefully throw you in your room. I know it was a home and they were trying to, they weren't on the rehabilitation side of things. They didn't care about you. I felt, you were there because you've been bad and we're going to teach you. And that's the feeling I got. It was never a nice place. I remember being at the breakfast table one morning and there was a boy beside me and they asked what I was in for. And I says, not going to school and listening to my teachers and my mum. And he's like, okay. And I says, what are you in for? And he says, I murdered my stepdad. And I was like, wow, So he's seen his stepfather hitting his mum over a few years on countless occasions. And on this one time, he just snapped and he thought, you're not going to hit my mum anymore. So he got a knife out the kitchen drawer and struck his stepdad once with a knife, and his stepdad passed away. So that boy was 14 as well. And he was kept in that home until he was 16, till he was eligible to get sent to prison, which I thought that's someone's life he's took, but it's a waste of his life as well. So it was a very rough, very hard home. And even though it's old wounds, it's kind of opened them up because recently I'd done a little check online and I went on to the historical records file and just asked them if they have any historical records of when I was in care and custody and things. And it's through your data protection, but they sent it all to me. But they did send me an email saying, please, when you look through this, look through it lightly because it can open up, like old wounds again. And that's when I realized there was things that I've been blocking out for years due to being in the home. So me reading through this file and seeing the abuse that went on and the physical and verbal abuse from the staff members, it was very hard to read, very hard. But that is a place in my life. That's in the past. Things happened. I wasn't there because I was a good boy, But
No.
yeah, things happen.
So you left there at 16.
Yes, I was in that care home. Things took a turn for the worse. When I was 14, just before I went, get sent to the care home, I met a girl in my local area. We were in the same class at school. We started dating, going out together. And just before I went into the care home, she fell pregnant with my child. So we were both 14 years old. We were
Gosh.
in the newspaper for being the youngest couple, I think, to have a kid at that time. So I had my daughter very young, 14, and when I came out of the care home, I tried to go back. We made kind of like a family setting. I went back with my girlfriend at the time. However, that led me on the path of drug use, and I started taking drugs, and she never took anything at all. But I think with everything else that had been going on in my life, I just resorted to drugs. So I stayed with her until my daughter was 4 or 5. She was just about to start primary one. And that's when I get an ultimatum, and she says, I just can't do this anymore. She says it's us two, or it's your life or drugs. And foolishly, I chose the drug life instead. So I lost my daughter from primary one until she was about 20 years old, when she'd get back in contact with me. But the good thing is, I've spoken to her and met up with her.
So you lost your daughter from 4 till 21.
Wow.
I mean, that must have brought back memories of you being away from your mum, the fact that you didn't see that daughter from 4 till 21.
It was so hard, very hard for me. But I think the drugs I was taking at the time put me in a bubble,
Yeah.
masked me from reality and everything else I felt inside. And it's unbearable to think now that I chose drugs over my kids. But since getting back in contact with her, and I've went and met her on several occasions, she says, "Dad, don't worry." She said, "That's fine. That's not the person you are today.
No.
Whatever you've done in the past, you know."
That's right. You were an addict, and as you say, that was all consuming for you. I assume were you living rough then, Steve? Living on the streets? Were you homeless?
Yes, after that, what happened is, I ended up on the streets, and I slept rough on the streets of Glasgow for 3 months. And that was a very hard time in my life. I was at the lowest of my low. I was a single person as well. I never had any dependents, so therefore, it was very hard to get any accommodation. Even hostels were taking girls and kids and things like that in first before single pet people. So it was very hard to get in. 3 months I lasted on the streets of Glasgow, and I just thought, you know, this is my life. This is the way it's going to end. So because of that, local to me as well, there's a place called Clydebank, which is well known for the shipbuilding era. It's built some of the biggest ships in Europe and in the world. And I remember walking down there one day. I was very depressed. I'm homeless. I've got nowhere to live. I'm only worrying about getting £10 just so my stomach doesn't hurt, you know, and get me through another day. And I was walking down by the riverside, and there was a big crane. It's called the Titan Crane. They've recently done it all up, and it's sort of an attraction. But back in the day when I was there, it was abandoned. It was an old crane. And I looked up at this crane, and I thought, I'm going to go a wee walk. And I walked up this crane, and I went on the outside of it, up all the stairs, right to the very, very top. And I walked to the very edge of the crane, and I'm looking down, and I'm just thinking to myself, there's nothing. I've got nothing to live for. I'm at lowest of my low. I don't want to put my family through any more pain. I don't want to cause anybody any more trouble. And I was just about to let go, and a gust of wind came and blew me, and I grabbed onto that bar, and that's when I realized in that split second that I wanted to live. I didn't want to die,
Amazing, yeah.
and I was crying, and I came back down off that crane. And it gets me to think sometimes, even though I was at the lowest point in my life, how many people are also at the lowest point of their life, and they make that split second decision, but it's too late for them. You know, so that was very tough for me. After that, I took a breakdown. I was admitted to hospital for just some rest, and get some fluids in me. And when I came out of the hospital, I was seen by a worker who worked for the local council, and she says, "We've got a place for you. It's in a local homeless shelter, but they're welcome to take you in. So I went up that night. It's called the Blue Triangle. There's 27 of these associations in Scotland. They took me in. There was no stigma. They didn't judge me whatsoever. And they says, you're welcome to stay here. You've got your own room, your toilet, your kitchen. Everything's yours. If you need help with benefits, we'll sort you out. If you need anything at all, let us know. And it was a staffed accommodation. So even though I was in this building with 9 or 10 other people, you had your own bedroom, which you could go away in and stay. But it was staff. So anytime at all you needed someone to talk to, the staff were there. And they took me in, and they only had two rules. And the rules were be in for 10 o'clock at night. Because if you're in after that, we need to lock the door so you won't get in. And don't take any drugs in the project. Do whatever you want outside. We know people struggle with addictions or alcohol and things. That's fine during the day, wherever you are, do what you do. We're not going to, look at you down for that. But just try not to do any drugs in the project. And I said, that's fine. If that's the only two rules that you have got, I'll stick by them. So I moved in there. And I stayed there for the next 18 months, 18 months in that accommodation. But everything they ever asked me to do, I'd done. If they ever had a meeting, I went to a meeting. I was still going out every day and I was taking drugs and smoking drugs and things, but I was coming home and I had my own wee room, my own wee comfort zone, my wee safe place, and I didn't cause anybody any problems or hassle. And one day they had a gentleman in who works through your local GP services, like addiction services. And his name was Jerry Blair. And Jerry came in one day and they set up a meeting for people in the project. And I was the only one that went down to the meeting. I think it was 9 or 10 people. And he says he's seen some potential in me. And I says, oh, that's great. So he got in tow with the big issue, and he asked if there's any chance I could be a vendor for them because he could see that I have potential and I might do good. And what they'd done is, yes, of course, but he would need to come to Glasgow City Centre. So the homeless project gave me a little travel warrant for on the bus and sent me up to Glasgow, and I went there and I walked into the big issue centre. And they got me a vest, they got me a badge, they took my photograph, put my photograph on it. They gave me a local pitch outside Asda. And to start with, they gave me 15 free magazines. And I don't know if you know this about people that sell the big issue. They need to buy that magazine first. So they're just not selling that magazine to you for free or whatever, a pound or two. They need to buy it first. So when I first bought the magazine, I think it was 60 pence I bought it for, and I sold it for £1.20. So to me, that was an investment. I seen that as this is a job, And every day I didn't bother anyone, I didn't steal off people, I didn't do bad things for what I needed, but I did work for it. So I sold the big issue selling these magazines, and then I would have enough at the end of the day. Yes, it would get me my drugs, but it would also get me some food for the rest of the day. And then I'd be fine in my wee room in the Blue Triangle again in the homeless project. So I think I took to that really well. And that instilled in me a few disciplines needed because every morning in that project, I would be up first thing, I would get washed, I would get dressed, and I would know I would need to travel to Glasgow. Buy my magazines so I can sell them on and double my money. So it gave me purpose. It gave me some discipline. It taught me a lot about lessons. I learned about money handling. I learned about dealing with customers. I learned just life skills in general. Basically, the starting blocks of what I needed to where I am today. So I think having that opportunity, even though it was a big issue and a lot of people look down on people that sell the big issue, there's a stigma to it. Oh, he's a junkie, he's an alcoholic, or he's an immigrant, whatever it may be. They helped me out big time. And for that, I think the big issue for that, they got me off the street. They got me making money for myself, learned some disciplines, gave myself some self-confidence and self-esteem. And 18 months after living in their project, I got my house, I got my first house. So yeah, it
Wow.
was good.
Wow. So how long did you sell the big issue for?
I sold the big issue for maybe about 9 months.
Right.
9 months, yes.
And so all this time you were still on drugs. When you bought your new house, were you still taking drugs?
Yeah.
How did you then get off this, if you like? How did you get off drugs?
What happened was, I used to wake up every morning and my stomach would hurt. And it was like the worst flu you've ever felt. Your nose would run, you'd start yawning, unbearable pains in your belly that you can't imagine. It's like someone putting their hand in your guts and just turning them round, and aches and pains and restless legs. And I just thought, I can't do this. I can't, I'm fed up. And all it was is I was just sick and tired. I've been sick and tired. That was it. And through doing well in the Blue Triangle in the project, in the homeless shelter, and selling the big issue, I got in contact again. I was on Facebook and I came across Lisa, who's my now wife. So I messaged Lisa, and I remember when I was young and in high school, I always used to chase Lisa, and she was a girl and that was trying to go with, trying to court, trying to date, and she would never have it. She wouldn't have it at all. She knew I was a bit of a bad boy, and she was letting me know clear, no, this is not happening. So after she seen me on Facebook and I messaged her, this was in 2010, 2011, and she offered me down to her house. I thought, oh, that's great. So I went down to Lisa's, and I haven't left since 2010.
Wow.
So that's how we started. So yeah, I met Lisa. She knew about my past. She knew I was a bit of a bad boy, and she understands that I was never a bad person. I just made bad choices, and I had a good heart at the end of the day. So I met Lisa. She had two older kids to a previous relationship, and she was living herself with the two kids. So I've felt very, I'm trying to think of the word for it. I didn't want to encroach on anyone's privacy when I started moving in with Lisa, especially the two boys. I didn't want to be like my stepmother was to me and be like, right, I'm your stepmother, you're going to do what I'm going to, you do what I say, sort of thing. So I was the opposite, and I thought, I'll let them be as they be. I won't tell them what to do. I won't say, oh, I'm your stepdad now and this and that, because I knew I didn't like that when that happened to me. And it took me a while to warm to everybody. Everybody had their own judgments, and maybe they've heard things and about the past or whatever. But that was it. I started staying with Lisa, and I think about 4 or 5 months went by, and I was doing great. I wasn't doing anything at all. I was on medication to get clean, so to speak. And out of nowhere, I had a blip. And this thing happened. Someone offered me some Valium tablets, and I said yes. And I should never have said yes, but I did. And before you know it, I took these tray of Valium tablets, and I can't remember what I was doing, where I was going, or anything. And 4 or 5 days later, I get picked up by the police and I get arrested, because on my possession was 500 tablets and an offensive weapon, which was nunchucks. So I get taken to court. I was kept in the cells, and I was taken to Dumbarton Sheriff Court on the Monday. And they took me up from the stairs in the dungeons, I call it. So they took me up from the dungeons up the stairs to face the judge in the dock. And that was just when I was coming round to my senses. So for 5 days, I can't remember a thing, nothing. And I was just coming round to my senses when I was getting dragged up the stairs in the court. And I remember the judge saying to me, "Mr. Murray, this is a very serious offence. You have been caught with an offensive weapon and 500 valiums in your possession." He says, "I was sentencing you to prison today if it wasn't for the lady sitting behind you." And I turned round and Lisa was in the gallery
Oh.
and I just burst out crying.
Yeah.
So
Oh.
I got bail that day with the skin of my teeth. And as I get bailed, I walked round to the front of the courthouse where my mum and Lisa was. And Lisa says, "Right, Stephen, this is it. It's me and the kids, or it's your life of drugs. But if you choose me and the kids, not another drug passes my front door unless a doctor's name's on it."
Right.
And I says, "Right, I'm ready." And
Oh,
that was the day I'd had enough. The judge gave me one more chance. Lisa gave me one more chance. I
yeah.
was sick and tired. I've been sick and tired. And I said, "Let's go." So from 2011 till today, I never touched another opiate. I went to the doctor with Lisa. I get put on a program. It was methadone at the time, to stabilize me off of heroin. So I started on methadone at a very high dose. And then gradually, every month, I came down 5 mils, 5 mils, 5 mils, till I got to 30 mils. And then I started taking a tablet, which was an opiate blocker. So I took this opiate blocker for a few months and came down off that, came down off that. So all in all, for the day I stepped out of the courtroom until the day I never took anything at all, it was 18 months on a treatment plan before I was even prescription free. So even though I was drug free, I was 18 months on a treatment plan
Yeah.
before I was prescription free. So the
Wow.
only thing that I take today are vitamins.
Oh, amazing. Oh, wow, what a story.
That's it.
Cool.
Yeah.
What a turnaround.
Yeah. And I think having that chance now, me looking back on it, I had that chance when my daughter was born, when she was 4 or 5 years old, and I got offered the same sort of ultimatum. I don't know if I was too young or I was too angry at the world,
Yeah.
but I said no and I chose drugs. I'll forever regret that, but I'm very proud today that she doesn't blame me for that. And she said, "Dad, I know that wasn't you. You know, you were a different person back then and you're not that person anymore." So just to have her blessing is fills me with pride, you know. Yeah.
The relationships that you've always had strong relationships with your family and, your girlfriend and your wife. How have you managed to hang on to those relationships? Because you were saying earlier about moving from school to school, it was so difficult to form relationships.
Yes.
What do you think it is that's helped you keep those relationships?
Having a strong desire to give my kids a better life than what I had, and to not set up the apple cart as such. I don't want my kids moving schools and going from home to home like I did. Since they've been born, we've stayed in this house. You know, and my kids now who I have to Lisa, we've got two other children. So we've got our two oldest boys who, when I first met Lisa, Thomas and Sean, they're now 20 and 24. And my two youngest are Miley and Stephen. Miley's 8 and Stephen's 9.
Oh,
And they're both firecrackers. But
no. You sound a very proud dad.
I am a very, very proud dad. I try my very best to give them a better life than what I had, but also as well to teach them life lessons along the way. My daughter Miley is only 8 years old, and she loves dancing. She's been dancing since she was 3 years old, and a couple of years ago she qualified for the dance championships in Ibiza.
Wow.
So we flew away out to Ibiza, where she danced there, and came home, and it was great. And she goes to all these competitions all over the place. Another big one's called Disco Kids in Blackpool. She loves that. But to date, I would say she has maybe 50 trophies for dancing.
Oh my gosh, you've become a dance dad.
I'm a dance dad, right? And my little boy, Stephen, he loves football.
Course.
He's in a local football team and he's won various trophies for that. And also, as well, he's a very keen dirt bike rider. He started when he was 3 years old asking if he can get the same bike like dad. So I went out and I got him this little 50cc restricted dirt bike. And for that day on, he loved it. So he's grew and progressed. I know it's not everyone's cup of tea, but he loves going in a muddy field and just having fun on his bike.
Sounds like you've worked through all your issues. What advice would you give other people to keep going and make it through like you have?
Never give up. That's it. Just never give up. When I was at the lowest in my life and I was homeless, standing on top of that crane at 160 foot high, looking down, thinking, there's nothing out there. There's nothing for me. I might as well go. I don't want to be a burden to anyone. And then that breeze ready to push me off and me clinging onto that crane. When I realized I really didn't want to die, really deep down, I was like, right, I don't want to die. That's when I realized whatever's out there's a higher power. Maybe whatever you believe in, whether it's God or something else, but I think there's a higher power and we're all here for a purpose. We just need to find out what our passion and our purpose is and charge at it full ahead.
Oh, on that occasion, did you take yourself off to hospital, realizing that's what you needed to do, or did somebody intervene?
No, I think something intervened. After that, when I came off the crane and I was just crying uncontrollably, I walked up to the local shopping centre area and I kind of remember just passing out almost as if. And then the ambulance crew coming, and saying, right, we'll take you to hospital. We think, you've had a wee bit of a breakdown. So something intervened in my life that day. Whatever that gentle breeze was that went to push me, there was something out there. And I ended up in hospital. But I think that's where I had to rest for a day or two just to reset myself and realize that I wanted to live.
Cool. Quite some journey you've been through. You say you've got a purpose now. What would you describe your purpose as?
Definitely, I've got discipline. I've got desire. I've shaped that purpose inside me. That is to help and inspire, empower other people daily, on a daily basis. And whether that's just giving someone that's down in their luck a couple of pounds because they're struggling, or saying to someone you want to get a wee chat and a cup of tea, I think the things inside me, it's about giving now. I don't want to take anything for life. I want to give now. So if I can give back to people that are struggling, that's my passion now. Anyone out there? I just actually created a website. It's called warham.scot and it's for anyone who's struggling with mental health problems. They can go on that website, even if they want to stay anonymous, they can just fill out a little box and say, listen, I'm struggling here, I don't know what to do. And I'll reach out with them, whether it's a text message or whether they want me to go and meet up with them, I'll do that as well.
Good. We'll make sure we put the details of that in our notes. It's fascinating to talk to you and find what you've all come through. I wanted to ask you a little bit about mental health. It's something, that we don't talk about. I mean, all of us have worked in schools and teachers, but you were t saying earlier when you've been to lots of different schools, you started rebelling rather than, I suppose, showing how you felt. What do you think we or other people should do really to talk about or encourage people to talk about how they're feeling rather than just acting out and rebelling?
That's a very tough question, actually. It'd be hard maybe for you to see the signs because someone that's struggling in school, that you might not see it. But then again, if you do and you do see someone rebelling against you, not doing what they're told, and you think this is he's just a wee troublemaker here. You know this. You've always got one in your class that you might be like, this is a hard one here. But maybe we need to think outside the box and think, why are they acting up? Why are they like that? Is it their environment they're in? Are they staying with a single parent, you know, just their mum or just their father? Maybe inside they're hurting. And I think that's what I was. I was hurting. And I took it out in the wrong ones, whether that be my teachers, the head teachers, family members. Yeah. So inside, I would say I was hurting. And maybe these people that act out are the same in school. Maybe they're hurting as well. So I would say try and take them aside and just reassure them. Let them know that if they ever need anything, you're there for them.
Similarly, having been on the streets, we all pass people all the time nowadays in cities and even small towns. So, from your point of view, what would you think is the best way to help or show concern or support for these people?
A cup of tea. That's it. A cup of tea. If you're near, if you see someone in the street sitting down, and they're homeless, go to the local Greggs. You know, go somewhere that you can just get McDonald's anywhere that's very local to where they are. Buy yourself a cup, buy them a cup of tea, and just offer them a cup of tea. And I bet they'll sit and talk with you. And before long, that stigma that you feel about them being homeless or on benefits or being a street bum, it'll all melt away and you'll realize it's just a person. You know, they've made bad choices in their life, but they're probably, most likely, they're not bad people. Yeah. So a cup of tea, that's all it takes, eh?
Because it is such a difficult situation for so many people. Thank you, Steve. Is there anything more you wanted to say that we haven't asked about or?
I don't think so. I'm very, I'm an open book. I have had a hard life, lots of traumas in my life, difficulties, things I've had to get over myself or been forced to get over with authorities. But I just think whatever you do in life, never give up. Just keep going, you know. I know it can be a struggle, it can be really hard, especially since the years that I have been clean. So all the years that I was taking drugs, I was in a bubble. All my feelings, emotions, everything I ever felt was all wrapped up in cotton wool and candy. And that's the way I felt. There was no reality. There was no bills to pay. There was no life stresses. Yeah, it was hard times in my life, but it wasn't as hard as being the way we all are today. We've got families, we've got lives and mortgages, we've got bills to pay, the cost of living's going through the roof. So even though it was hard, I would say it's also equally as hard to be free of drugs. However, when I was in drugs, my mental health was never an issue. It's when I became clean that OCD, I've been diagnosed with OCD. See a psychologist as well, have sessions with a psychologist for PTSD, past traumas that when I was abused in the care home, I suffer from depression, anxiety, I have weekly panic attacks, but these are all things now that I learned to live with. So my depression's not just going to get up and go. I know that it's something that's with me, something that will live with me. But when it comes back now, which it always does, it just comes round in little circles. But when it comes back now, I tell myself, you're only going to feel this way for a day or two. Then it will pass. Then you'll be back to your normal chirpy, cheery self. So don't worry, because this too shall pass.
This day will pass. Exactly. I think you said earlier it's only a chapter, it's not the book.
Most definite. Your life, you've got a whole book ahead of you, and whatever's happened in your past, that is only a chapter of your life. So don't sit and stew on the past. You know, let it be a lesson. There's blessings and lessons, so take it as you can, but always move on. Look back in the past, look at the good times, Look at the lessons you've learned, but always move on, always move forward.
Yeah. And I think it's important that you say it, you know, it's not easy, is it? You, as you say, when you were in that bubble, it was in some ways easier, but now there are struggles and it's not easy, but
of
it's
course
the right thing for you, and that's the way you're going to keep on.
I'm definitely going to keep on like this, yeah. I would say I'm more of a given person now. I have no stigma or stereotypes against anyone. I think we're all in this world together, you know. That's all we can do is try and get on with each other.
Yeah.
So, yeah, moving on, people say as well, money doesn't buy you happiness. But I disagree, because I believe when you give away money, that brings you happiness. So whenever I have a little bit extra, I'll give it to someone which is in need. And the pride I get from that is worth more than the money itself.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah, it's been fascinating to listen to your story. You sound like a really larger than life character. Definitely.
Thank you.
You've certainly got the gift of the gab, Steve. I can imagine you know why you did so well selling those big issues.
No, and I had some lovely customers and regular customers, and that is it. See, the thing is, see, if no one came up and bought me a magazine or gave me a couple of pound, it was fine. But see those people that came up and they just wanted to speak and they had a smile on their face, that made my day.
Yeah.
You know, so never think that, oh, I can't approach someone who's homeless or down on the luck. But just go up to them, you know, because maybe all it takes is just a smile. And that is one smile away could be from them doing something bad to themselves or having a really good day. So, yeah, just go up to them, have a wee talk, and they'll be an open book as well, I'm sure, and let you know how they are.
Yeah.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for giving us your time. And do enjoy the rest of your day. What's your company called? Crime Scene Cleanup? Or?
Yes. That's what I meant to tell you in the interview, didn't I? That I became a crime scene cleaner. Yes, I forgot to mention that. So as I've been with Lisa and we've moved on in life and I became drug-free, I actually got my passport. So I've got a passport now. I'd done my driving lessons, I passed my driving test, I got a car, I've been in holidays, I've been in different countries around the world. This is all just in 10 years. Just in 10 years I've been drug-free. I started my own business. I thought I would try and take the trauma away from family members that need to go through certain things and they don't need to see that. So to get qualified and certified for that, we had to do a very intense training course.
Yeah.
And there's nowhere that trains you in Scotland. There's nowhere that trains you in England. You need to go to Wales. So I had to save up £1,500 each. So I saved up £1,500 for me, £1,500 for Lisa. We scrimped and saved every penny we had. And then I drove all the way to Wales. And we done our intense training course. And at the end of the training course, they said, that's your certified crime scene cleaner. So we're part of a big network now. And we're on call. So we can get a call out at any time to go anywhere. We've been up to the north of Scotland as far as you can go on calls. So we've been to Edinburgh, to Glasgow, just wherever it takes us. And sometimes it's just not all doom and gloom. You're there because you're taking the trauma away from a family member. They maybe not need to see what's left behind after their loved one's been taken away into care, you know. So if we can go there and make that place look as if nothing ever happened there, then I feel like I've done my job.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a whole another episode, isn't it?
There we go, we need a part two. So we can do a part two on that. Yeah.
Definitely.
From crime to grime.
Yes. I'll make that the title, shall I?
It sounds like a Channel 4 documentary, actually.
Yeah, no, that's good. I'd love to talk to yous again. So if yous ever want to arrange another wee Zoom call or a meeting in the future, I'm more than happy.
We're all smiling here as you've obviously lifted our spirits today. So thank you very much, Steve, and we will hopefully talk to you another time.
Yeah, thank you for the insight.
No problem at all. Thanks very much for having me.
Oh, what a lovely, positive, happy, upbeat person, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can understand why people might be drawn to him, you know. He's very gregarious, isn't he? Very easy to talk to.
Listening to Steve just reminded us again how important relationships are to all of us.
And as Steve said, just take 5 minutes out of your day to sit, buy a cup of tea, and talk to someone who's homeless.
It could make all the difference. So thank you again to Steve, and thank you to you, our listeners. If you've got any questions or feedback, please do contact us on our social media pages. We are always ready to listen. Thank you. Till next time.